Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 4th of June. Our main stories: thousands of demonstrators in Hong Kong defy a police ban to mark the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. After a year-long battle, Libya's internationally recognised government says it's regained full control of Tripoli. And a warning that millions of youngsters are missing out on childhood vaccines because of the coronavirus pandemic. Also in the podcast, 13 years on, have German investigators finally solved the disappearance of Madeleine McCann?
Prosecution is investigating against a 43-year-old German on suspicion of murder. We are assuming that the girl is dead.
And for the first time, Mexico reports more than 1,000 coronavirus deaths in a single day. But as businesses reopen, is there enough testing? Every year on the 4th of June, people in Hong Kong gather to mark the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. But now, for the first time in 3 decades, the authorities have tried to stop them holding a candlelit vigil. The official reason was to prevent the spread of COVID-19. But critics see the heavy hand of the communist authorities in China, who ban all mention of the killing of hundreds, possibly thousands of protesters in Beijing in 1989. And so hundreds of people in Hong Kong defied the ban and made their way to Victoria Park.
We feel like the June 4th massacre is actually a significant historical event that marks the beginning of the brutal suppression of the Chinese communist regime, that we hope that our future generations would remember how brutal the regime is and how reluctant they are towards democratization, that they will use tanks to suppress students.
Generally, everyone's scared. The situation has gone out of hand. I think coming to Victoria Park is a symbolic meaning, but I think this symbolic meaning has been diminished. And I'm lucky that I've been last year, because I think this is the last time we have in Victoria Park.
The peaceful protest came on the day that pro-Beijing legislators in Hong Kong passed a bill making it an offence punishable by up to 3 years in jail to insult the Chinese national anthem. And of course, China is also planning to impose a national security law on Hong Kong. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, knows the territory well. So what did she make of people ignoring the police ban and holding a vigil for the Tiananmen Square massacre?
Nobody was really surprised when the police refused permission for the vigil to go ahead. That's because tensions are running so high in Hong Kong right now. But almost as soon as that ban was announced, the organizers of the vigil and many other people came out to say, well, I'm going to go anyway. I'm still going to go and mark this event. And so really, it's not a surprise. The police had put up barricades all around the park, but those barricades were soon pushed over. And yes, the park is now full. Interestingly, people are still observing, by and large, social distancing. You know, the police cited virus concerns when they refused for the vigil to go ahead. Police have now surrounded the park, and they're using loudspeakers to play warning messages that people are not allowed to gather in groups of more than 8. And so really, it's now just a waiting game to see if the police are going to allow that vigil to continue or whether they're going to try to push into the park and use those their apparent concerns about the spread of the coronavirus in order to shut down the vigil.
Yeah, we can hear a little bit of chanting from the park. This comes on the day that, pro-democracy campaigners would see it, more provocation linked to the authorities, the communist authorities in Beijing. That law passed in the Hong Kong Assembly banning any insults to the Chinese national anthem. Why did they feel the need for a law there?
Well, this is a battle that goes back quite a few years. For at least 10 years now, people in Hong Kong have been booing when the Chinese national anthem is played. This often happens in international football matches. This has certainly happened in many sports events in Hong Kong, where many sports fans will make it clear that they don't feel that the Chinese national anthem represents them. They feel really that they're part of Hong Kong, and they really are pushing that idea that Hong Kong is separate from the rest of China. However, China's leaders really took offense at this, and they've wanted Hong Kong to enact a law similar to the one that's in place in mainland China, making it an offense to insult or mock the Chinese national anthem. And so really, this is really pushing the power of pro-Beijing lawmakers in the Hong Kong legislature. They hold two-thirds of the seats. Many of them are simply appointed to their seats. They're not directly elected. And they really pushed this law through. Now, why they decided to really antagonize people by making sure that this law was going to get a second vote on June 4th, which is such a sensitive day because of the 1989 anniversary, I don't know. It's really interesting that the authorities seem to be gearing up for some kind of confrontation with people who really feel that China is really exerting too much control in Hong Kong at the moment.
Celia Hatton, and after I spoke to her, we received reports from Hong Kong that police had made arrests and used pepper spray to disperse protesters in the shopping area of Mong Kok in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, on the Chinese mainland, a security guard has attacked primary school students and teachers, leaving 39 people injured, two in a serious condition. Stephen McDonald reports from Beijing.
It's not yet known why the security guard started attacking staff and students with a knife at the primary school where he worked in China's Guangxi region. 37 young children have been injured. Two adults are said to be in a serious condition, the school principal and another security guard. Eight ambulances were sent to the Wangfu Town Central Primary School to race the injured to hospital. The man in his 50s has now been detained by the police, who say they're investigating what happened. In the past, such attacks on students in China have been prompted by local grievances. Some have been carried out by assailants with mental health problems.
Stephen McDonald. For more than a year, the internationally recognised government in Libya has been battling to stop the capital Tripoli being overrun by the rebel forces of General Khalifa Haftar. Backed by a rival government in the east of Libya, as well as the UAE, Egypt and Russia, he had some military success. But now the UN-backed government, with the support of Turkey, says it's regained control of Tripoli after taking the international airport, as I heard from our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher.
The recapture of the airport itself, I mean, as is often the case, is kind of largely symbolic. It's not been in use since 2014, but it's that area and the other areas of the southern suburbs where General Haftar's forces had established a front line. They'd established their positions. They were continuing to shell residential areas in Tripoli. There was a very nasty attack at the weekend, which hit a park and killed several people. So it's that ability that the government has been able to demonstrate now that it has forced General Haftar's militias out of that area. So, you know, that is a sort of sign that the siege of Tripoli, for now at least, seems to be over. That started, as you said, more than a year ago, back in April. And back then, I mean, the government, such as it is, you know, was seen as very fragile, only in control of a few streets around where it's based. And the backing internationally that General Haftar had at the time, the impetus that he had coming across from the east, he'd taken, you know, one city, one town after another. It looked like he was going to have quite an easy victory. That never happened. There's been a bloody stalemate for a long time. What's changed the dynamics, what's changed the equation, is that Turkey has come in fully behind the government in Tripoli in the past few months. It signed a deal back in November. It's given absolutely crucial military support, drones on the ground. Militias from the Syrian conflict have been drafted in by Turkey, and that has changed things hugely. There's been a drive for the past 2 months or so that's seen the forces of the government force back General Haftar's forces again and again, take back key areas around Tripoli. And now this is the culmination of that for now. The siege of Tripoli, at least as far as the government is concerned, is over.
Sebastian Usher. Health experts are warning that tens of millions of babies and children are missing out on vital childhood vaccines because of the coronavirus pandemic. Diseases which had been previously brought under control are reappearing. The warning from the UN comes as the UK hosts a virtual vaccine summit. Our global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumdar, reports. The
This is usually a bustling, busy immunisation clinic in Niger's capital, Niamey. But today, just a few mums have come with their small babies. Restrictions on movements, a shortage of healthcare workers, problems with vaccine supplies, and parents' fear of catching COVID-19 have meant many families have stayed away. But Zainabou Tahiou has come with her little baby girl.
I was so scared to come here because of the virus, but health workers have told me it's very important to come for my baby and what to do to stay safe, like wearing this mask and washing my hands all the time.
There have been almost 1,000 cases of COVID-19 reported in Niger, but at the same time, polio is also making a resurgence in the country. There have been 4 cases of what's called vaccine-derived polio reported since February. 3 of them were picked up in March alone. Many countries were advised by the World Health Organization to suspend vaccination campaigns to help stop the spread of coronavirus. But now there's a stark warning about the longer-term impact of this disruption.
Measles is on the rise, diphtheria, cholera. So all of these issues are going to be a real problem.
That's Henrietta Fore, head of the UN's children's agency, UNICEF.
As a world, we had conquered in this past century many of these preventable diseases for children. And so we made great gains on childhood survival. And what is now threatened is all of those gains in the last 30 years, that we will wipe them away just because children are not getting immunizations.
It's estimated that more than 34 million children have missed routine vaccinations in Southeast Asia. Both Nepal and Cambodia are facing significant measles outbreaks. In Africa, it's estimated almost 23 million children haven't been immunized. Ethiopia is currently fighting measles, cholera, and yellow fever outbreaks. Henrietta Fore from UNICEF says the consequences of all this could be utterly devastating.
There's a new study out by Johns Hopkins University, and what it says is that we should be concerned, worry about 6,000 deaths per day for the next 6 months because of children who are missing out on these immunizations. We do not want to trade one crisis, a COVID crisis, for another crisis, one that is that children are dying.
Medical staff around the world are working tirelessly to try and ensure that dire prediction doesn't come to pass.
Julia Mazumdar reporting. And before we move on, a quick reminder about our new podcast, Spitfire, The People's Plane. Using audio archive, diaries and music, it tells the story of the aircraft that helped secure victory in Europe in the Second World War. And still to come on this podcast...
I used to believe everything they said on Russian TV, she tells me. I don't believe a word now.
How the coronavirus outbreak in Russia has hurt President Putin's opinion ratings. According to the White House, President Trump has restored peace to America's streets after he threatened to send in soldiers to quell violence following the death of the unarmed black man George Floyd. However, the former U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis has accused the president of trying to divide Americans during the racial unrest. Mr. Trump responded by calling him the world's most overrated general. George Floyd died 10 days ago in Minneapolis after a white police officer pinned him to the ground. Today, a memorial service will be held in the city. Barbara Platusha reports.
New charges for all 4 police officers involved in the arrest of George Floyd. It's what protesters had been demanding.
I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. I think the most important thing is that people continue to protest and push and fight beyond these charges.
A battle's been won. We still got to fight a war. It's not over yet. It's a start. And we still got a long way to go.
Still, a reason to celebrate here at the memorial site set up on the spot where Mr. Floyd gasped out his last breath. It's been a painful reckoning for many. I caught up with 2 cousins from a mixed-race family trying to take it all in.
It's just heartbreaking to see a black man die for no reason. They didn't even have the decency to take their knee off of him once he was lifeless.
He was handcuffed. He was compliant. He said, please don't kill me. He said, I can't breathe. There was nothing no one could do because at the end of the day, the cops have power over us and we're tired.
90% of the Minneapolis police officers do not live in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
They live in the suburbs, so they come in like an invading army, and then at the end of the day, they get to go home to their quiet, peaceful suburban house where there ain't no black people.
The last time I was in Minneapolis was 4 years ago, after a young black man, Philando Castile, was stopped while driving and shot dead by a policeman. His best friend, Greg Crockett, had since moved away. But he returned when he saw how the city was rallying over the death of another black man.
You know, I'm not my granddaddy. I ain't scared. You know, I'm not scared of anybody. I'm not scared of no KKK or whatever it is. I'm not scared. So I'm here. I'm activated.
Do you think there could be change this time?
I don't know if there's ever going to be real change, because I honestly don't feel like this will ever stop, you know, because it's never not stopped for as long, like since we couldn't work for them for free no more. You know, they've just been killing black folks left and right.
I asked the women the same question.
Does it feel different this time, the response?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think the fact that everyone's standing with Minnesota and supporting us, and it's nationwide, it's worldwide, that people are just supporting us in general is amazing.
What's his name?
George Floyd!
What's his name?
George Floyd!
What's his name?
George Floyd!
A report from Minneapolis by Barbara Plett-Usher. The family of a 16-year-old Aboriginal Australian is considering a private prosecution of a police officer filmed slamming him to the floor. The man was shown tripping up the boy, who was then pinned to the ground during his arrest in Sydney. 30% of Australia's prison inmates are Indigenous, as are half of those in youth detention. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
An internal police investigation is focusing on whether excessive force was used in the arrest of the Aboriginal teenager in Sydney. On a video, he's heard threatening to hit an officer. The boy is then thrown to the ground, apparently landing on his face. His family says if the junior constable isn't charged, they'll take civil action against him. The arrest has reignited the debate about how Indigenous people are treated by Australia's law enforcement agencies.
Phil Mercer. In 2007, a three-year-old British girl called Madeleine McCann vanished while on holiday with her parents in Portugal. All the police leads came to nothing, and it seemed the case might never be solved. Now, though, there is an apparent breakthrough in Germany. A state prosecutor there, Hans-Christian Wolters, says a suspect named as Christian B., who's already serving a prison sentence for other offences, is being investigated in relation to the disappearance of Madeleine McCann.
The prosecution is investigating against a 43-year-old German on suspicion of murder. We are assuming that the girl is dead. With the suspect, we're talking about a multiple sexual predator who has been convicted for crimes against little girls, and he is already serving a long sentence.
Julian Reichelt is editor-in-chief of the German newspaper Bild, told us more about how Christian B. emerged as a suspect.
He is in prison in the city of Kiel right now here in Germany. And there is some indication that we are hearing that somehow from maybe other people in prison, from, you know, the whole prison environment he is in right now, some new information emerged that basically pushed investigators towards Christian B. Because everything we've heard so far publicly has been around and basically known to police in Germany and in Britain for years, and now opened, as we just heard from the prosecutor there in Braunschweig, opened a murder case investigation. It's also a bit shocking that from that file and from knowing that that person has lived in the area of question, that he wasn't on the radar before, because he has been convicted of child abuse as early as 1994. And it wasn't the only time. There are numerous other convictions, drug convictions, driving under the influence, driving without a driver license. It's a huge, numerous page long criminal record that we have seen. But what is most striking is that there's a clear history of child abuse. It seems to, indeed a bit odd that this person wasn't on the radar in the past 13 years.
Julian Reichelt of the German newspaper Bild. Vladimir Putin has been in power in Russia for 2 decades, seeing off all challenges with apparent ease. Now, though, amid the suffering caused by the coronavirus lockdown, his popularity is sinking, according to opinion polls. Our correspondent Steve Rosenberg has been to his home city of St. Petersburg to gauge the mood.
In her tiny St. Petersburg kitchen, Milana Ivanova is making dinner. Onions, 1 can of beef, and a packet of pasta. All of this is from a food parcel. Because in the economic crisis sparked by COVID, Milana and her husband have lost their jobs, with a florist and a travel company. They have a 12-year-old daughter, and state benefits don't cover the bills. So they're relying on charity. How come, Milana asks, that in America and in Germany and in other countries, people received real help from their governments, but we didn't? We feel abandoned. The result is disillusionment with the man who's been running Russia for 20 years. If Putin was sitting where you are, says Milana, I'd ask him, does he really know what's going on? How people live? How we're struggling? She was a Putin fan, she says. She trusted him, but not anymore. What Milana is saying, many Russians may now be thinking. With Russia facing a deep recession, Vladimir Putin's approval rating is the lowest in 20 years.
The government of Vladimir Putin is facing pretty acute risk of open public discontent.
Mikhail Dmitriev is a political scientist. His latest study confirms that the president is shedding support.
The situation is quite grave. And the main reason is that incomes fell by over 10% since 2013. And now they fell down again. And the patience of the public is basically close to be exhausted.
For President Putin, this fall in popularity is bad timing. In less than a month, Russians will vote on his proposal to change the constitution to allow him to run for office 2 more times. He can always rely on state TV for positive spin. Trouble is, Milana has switched off. I used to believe everything they said on Russian TV, she tells me. I don't believe a word now. I've stopped watching. Instead, Milana is glued to social media. She began by watching fluffy animal videos, she says. Now it's Kremlin critics she clicks on. She shows me one post. A woman says, presidents should be changed as often as babies' nappies. If they make a mess, get a new one. Seeing Milana online and the food parcel on the table, I'm reminded of a battle you often hear about in Russia. The battle between the TV set and the fridge. The TV that's pumping out positive messages about life and the leader, and the fridge, which, when you open it, reveals the economic reality.
Steve Rosenberg reporting from St. Petersburg. On Wednesday, the health authorities in Mexico reported 1,092 coronavirus deaths, the highest daily figure yet. However, the country has already begun to reopen its economy. Industries permitted to return to work include car park manufacturing plants and construction sites, as well as beer factories and bike shops. Mexico has one of the lowest levels of testing in the Americas, and some scientists fear the decision to reopen has come too early. Our Mexico correspondent Will Grant reports.
Officially, Mexico has lost 10,000 people to coronavirus. Among them was Homero Servando, a member of the Masawa ethnic group who succumbed to the virus in his impoverished town in the state of Mexico. To the strains of mariachis singing a traditional lament, he was buried beneath the dusty earth by his community, Mexico's indigenous poor among the most vulnerable to coronavirus. But the true number of dead may be far higher. Mexico's testing rate is among the lowest in Latin America, with fewer than 1 in 1,000 tested for COVID-19. At the National Polytechnic Institute in Mexico City, suspected patients have swabs and blood samples taken. But nationally, the policy is only to test the most severe cases, with the government saying it is unconvinced that testing is so key to controlling the virus. The policy is causing confusion and distress for some family members. My boy is here with pneumonia, says Rogelio Hernandez outside a hospital in Acapulco. But we have no information or any document that says he was tested for COVID. No way of knowing what he has.
I would say the response was characterized by delays, by minimization, at some point even trivialization. And I think we're paying a very high price for those initial delays.
Dr. Julio Frenk was the health secretary in Mexico under President Vicente Fox. I spoke to him via Skype from Miami, where he is now president of the University of Miami. He said he found the lack of a thorough testing program in his native Mexico inexplicable.
This idea that you can navigate such a complex emergency in the absence of extensive testing is baffling. And yet I have found people, even in the Ministry of Health of Mexico, trying to rationalize the low level of testing by saying that it's not really necessary. But, you know, tests are the eyes of the epidemiologic surveillance system. If you don't test, You are basically blind.
Si seguimos cuidándonos.
Yet despite it all, Mexico is reopening for business.
Si salimos de.
The president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has even embarked on a national tour, including several states experiencing the peak of the pandemic. If we continue to take care with social distancing, only leave home for the most essential tasks, and follow the health measures, then little by little we can return to normality, he insisted. He did, however, clarify that if there's a second outbreak, Mexico would close back up again.
Testing, testing, testing. It is absolutely critical.
Dr. Julio Frenk says the López Obrador administration shouldn't be concerned about a second wave, but rather concentrate on dealing with this first one.
Let's deploy tests both for surveillance and for diagnosis. Let's institute a system of tracing. Let's go back to what's the standard public health response, which is you identify cases, you trace contacts, and you isolate and quarantine only those people. You don't ask everyone to quarantine.
In Ciudad Neza, meanwhile, on the outskirts of Mexico City, family members find any vantage point they can outside the hospital to hold up signs. They read, "We love you," and "Trust in God, you will get out of this." Their loved ones, behind the windows inside their COVID-19 ward, wave back. With the numbers in Mexico still worsening, they are unsurprisingly desperate to get their family members home again. Mainly because there have been too many scenes like this in Mexico. A socially distanced funeral, mourners attending like a drive-through, not leaving their cars to pay their respects, but simply rolling slowly past the coffin. Mexico has a huge economic need to return to work, with the economy facing serious difficulties. However, while testing remains so scarce, many fear the worst is still to come.
That report by our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant. And just before we go, a quick thank you to Roy Del Valle in the Philippines, who emailed us to say, "I've been listening to your podcast since March. We're on the longest lockdown in Asia and are only just beginning to ease restrictions. Your show has helped me maintain a sense of connectedness amidst this isolation. And I love how you always try your best to end your show on a hopeful note." And on that hopeful note from Roy, that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to get in touch, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.